Hello and welcome to Narrative, a journey into the ancient art of storytelling, a place to gather by the fire and share the stories of our ancestors, a place to gather and tell our own tales. Here we will explore legends, fairy tales, myths, and folklore. We'll have conversations around archetypes, history, theology, and the ancient mysteries, as well as having discussions on how it all pertains to our lives. Before carvings or hieroglyphs or written word, our ancestors kept their stories alive through oral tradition. In honoring them, I too want to continue this path. Thank you for joining me. I am your host, Mary Rogers. In today's episode, I want to share the story of Inanna, the Sumerian goddess of love, war, and fertility. Also known as the Queen of Heaven, Inanna is her Sumerian name, but she's also known as Ishtar in Akkadian, Aphrodite in Greece, and she's often called the Morning Star and is associated with the goddess Venus in Rome. In some stories, Inanna, or Ishtar, eventually incarnates as Isis, who is later depicted as either Mary Magdalene or the Blessed Mother, depending on the story variation. Inanna is also linked to Lilith. There's a Sumerian tale about the Tree of Wisdom in the story of Enki and the World Order. In that story, Inanna is a virgin and she eats from this tree, the Tree of Knowledge. And afterwards, it's said that she knows sex, which I think really means she knows about the initiation of destruction and incarnation. Inanna eventually replants and relocates this tree. And when she does, she realizes that Lilith, who's said to be the first woman prior to Eve, has taken residence inside the tree. There are also tales that claim Lilith was a sacred prostitute to Ishtar. And there's some pathwork out there that indicates Inanna was actually Eve. Eventually, all of these goddesses and incarnations will be spotlighted. But today, we're going to focus primarily on the descent of Inanna, a story that has been recited in mystery schools throughout time. In cultural context, or as a timeline, the story began circulating around 6,000 years ago in ancient Sumer, which is now known as southern Iraq. And in setting up today's pathwork, I want to give a definition to the underworld and also define what a dark goddess is. The underworld in ancient mythology was not seen as fire and brimstone. Those concepts came much later. The underworld is spoken of in mythology as a mysterious and shadowy place beyond ordinary human experience. The underworld is the realm of the dead, the destination of human souls in the afterlife. And in some traditions, it's also the home of non-human, supernatural, or otherworldly beings such as fairies, demons, giants, and monsters. And it is usually portrayed as something terrifying, dangerous, or an often unpredictable place. But really, the underworld appears as a source of growth, life, and rebirth. And the most common idea of the underworld is that it lies beneath the everyday world, but it's more than just a physical realm. The souls of the dead are the principal travelers, but sometimes living heroes, mystics, and shamans will also make this journey, as will we, everyday humans, when we're working to heal the fragmented pieces of our soul. Dark goddesses possess qualities that are mysterious, magical, chaotic, destructive, violent, but transformational. They hold qualities that challenge, disrupt, that create chaos and disorder. Because of this, they're often seen as wild and uncontrollable, often untamed. Dark goddesses really are primal or primordial selves. In going through the descent of Inanna, while the story itself is not very long, it's so full of symbolism. And while I've been trying to keep the mystery school teachings within a space, meaning I share a story with just enough detail, just enough insights to hopefully inspire you into doing your own contemplation and research, the story has so much symbolism that unless you've already been an initiate or an adept, there's just a lot of things you may not come to on your own. So today I will be interjecting some interesting details, insights, and deeper understandings. From the great above, she opened her ear to the great below. So the story begins with Inanna, hearing her sister, who's the queen of the underworld, wailing in grief as her husband has died. Now it's been said that the queen of heaven, Inanna, and the queen of the underworld were twins. As above, so below. And these words are actually written on the Emerald Tablets by Tho, the thrice-born, who in last week's episode we learned was actually Enki. And in this tale, Enki, in different variations or versions, is either Inanna's father, grandfather, or uncle. So Inanna, hearing the inconsolable cries of her sister, prepares to journey to the underworld. But natural law states that anyone who enters the underworld cannot return. And this is a really big deal. Inanna is responsible for the crops. So if she doesn't return, the people will starve. Knowing this, Inanna provides instructions to her minister as to what should be done in the event she doesn't return. And then she sets forth in preparing herself with sacred garments, 7 divine powers to ensure her return. The story then goes on to list the 7 temples in the city-states she will be leaving behind as she journeys into the underworld. You're going to find that 7 is a reoccurring number throughout the story and many others, which signifies its importance. In the Bible, the number 7 is recorded over 700 times, from the 7 days of creation to the many 7s in Revelations. The number 7 represents completion and perfection, exoneration and healing, and the fulfillment of promises and oaths. Okay, so Inanna is preparing herself. She's adorning herself with these 7 holy garments. That the text actually says she took the 7 divine powers. Essentially, she wore a wig with a crown of heaven on top. She hung small lapis lazuli beads around her neck. She placed egg-shaped beads on her breast and wore a sacred breastplate over her chest. She wore a golden ring and carried her scepter, the rod of power. After some time, Inanna finally arrives at the first gate of the underworld and knocks on the door. The chief doorman, Neti, calls out, "Who is it?" "I'm Inanna, and I'm traveling to the east." If you're Inanna going to the east, why have you traveled to the land of no return? How did you set your heart on the road whose traveler never returns? Inanna then explains that she's there because her sister's husband died. So Neti says, "Hold on," and goes to make the queen of the underworld aware that her sister, Inanna, has arrived. So the queen of the underworld demands the 7 gates be bolted. They can be opened one by one, just enough for Inanna to squeeze through. But here's the catch. At each landing, she is to remove one of her sacred garments before descending to the next gate or portal. Neti does as commanded, and each gate that Inanna passes through, she is stripped. First her crown, then her wig, then the necklace, the breastplate, and so forth. Until at last, she passes through all 7 gates and arrives to the throne room, stripped completely naked and bowed very low. Now, I just want to interject here for a second. Many have surmised that the 7 gates or the 7 garments correspond to the 7 chakras, energy centers which are within our bodies. But I also want to point out that it's similar in Hermeticism in the ascension of the body through the 7 planetary bodies, in which you surrender 7 parts of your being, or the 7 bodies of man, before you can rejoin the totality by accessing the thick stars. Obviously, in the tale of Inanna's descent, she's descending rather than ascending. But much of the correlation or idea is the same, only here it's reversed. It also reminds me of the 7 stages of the alchemical process, where a matter of unadorned earth goes through 7 stages to refine it further and further and further, until finally you're left with this essence to discover its true name. So here we have Inanna. Literally nothing remains as she enters the throne chamber. She's been stripped completely bare. And now she's surrounded by these elemental beings or forces who start yelling at her and screaming and passing judgment. And in the end, they deem her unworthy. You're also going to see a lot in these underworld stories, this judgment process that happens. So in Egypt, right, we have Anubis, who weighs the heart against the feather. Inanna is crouched down, she's naked, she's being yelled at, screamed at, judgments are being hurled her way. And then her sister, the queen of the underworld, unleashes her fury, her vengeance, and kills Inanna. And then she takes Inanna's corpse and hangs it on a meat hook, where it hangs for 3 days. And I just want to take a moment to point out that we see this idea of death and body suspension in a lot of mythology, and it's also carried over to religion. Here we could think of Jesus and his being suspended on a cross and how he was dead also for 3 days. In Norse mythology, you have Odin, the Allfather, god of runes, magic, knowledge, and wisdom. And when he was trying to acquire the knowledge of the runes, he hung himself to the Yggdrasil tree for 9 days. So again, when a theme repeats throughout stories, time, history, and culture, we know there's something important here. There's something of significance, and we're supposed to pay attention. And there's this reoccurring theme that when a god or heavenly or holy being is making a sacred pilgrimage in some way to acquire this thing, when one is trying to acquire knowledge or wisdom or ancient universal secrets, something within yourself must first be sacrificed. Because honestly, it's the initiation of death and resurrection and everything in between that allows us to gain these insights and acquire the knowledge we've been seeking. And it's quite possible to go through this process 1,000 times in each of our lifetimes. This might be an ego death or many. It could be a spiritual death. Or even when our own loved ones begin to pass away, where we do experience a physical death and loss. In this time, we often enter the underworld through grief, and we often return with clarity around mortality, how short life can be, how to not waste our time, and to stop waiting for tomorrow. We learn how to be present and live in the moment, how to never waste an opportunity to tell someone how much they mean to us, or tell our loved ones how we really feel. And after our journey to the underworld, we usually return so tender. We've experienced loss and the gut-wrenching agony of having your heart torn in two, which means there's a softening, an opening. I also can't help but think of the Hangman in Tarot in the Major Arcana, which coincidentally is a card of knowledge and wisdom and of gaining secrets. But when you look at the card, there he is, hanging upside down. And again, we're finding that these stories carry a reoccurring theme of the number 3. Inanna was dead for 3 days. Jesus was dead for 3 days. Odin was dead for 9, but 9 is still a derivative of 3. In fact, it's literally 3 times 3. The number 3 is actually considered a perfect number. It's the number of harmony, wisdom, and understanding. It's also the number of time, past, present, future, birth, life, death, the beginning, middle, and the end. Like the Holy Trinity, 3 is the number of the divine. Okay, so back to Inanna. It's been 3 days, and she hasn't returned to heaven. Her minister's concerned and starts carrying out the instructions Inanna had given her before she left. She goes through all the steps, and finally, after pleading on Inanna's behalf, Enki finally concedes to intervene. In order to do so, he has to create these demons that can enter the underworld. And just to clarify, demons were considered elemental forces or beings that can be commanded and summoned to do one's bidding. In ancient terms, the word demon didn't mean something negative or evil. They were neither good nor bad. They literally just carried out instructions, like a golem. So Enki creates these demons, and he gives one the food of life, and to the other he gives the water of life. And these little demons, the story likens them to flies. They have the ability to travel to the underworld and slip through the door pivots like phantoms. So this is what they do. When they get to the throne room, they find the queen of the underworld writhing in pain. The story kind of explains it like she's going through childbirth, or as though she just gave birth or is in labor. Although I do know from personal experience that grief can also feel much the same way. Anyway, as she cries out, "Oh, my heart," the demons repeat her in a coaxing, soothing manner, as though they understand her pain. So as she says, "Oh, my heart," they repeat, "Oh, my heart." And this continues on for a while. Every time she moans or cries out, they repeat what she has said, and they comfort her. The queen of the underworld is moved by their compassion, so much so that she starts offering them gifts as repayment for their kindness. A river with all of its water. A field with all of its grain. But the demons reject every offer. Finally, somewhat agitated, the queen of the underworld throws her hands in the air and is like, "Okay, well, what is it that you do want? Give us the corpse hanging on the hook," they say. That corpse is your queen, she replies. Whether it's that of our king or that of our queen, give it to us. So in keeping with her word, the queen of the underworld gives them Inanna. One demon sprinkles the life-giving food. The other does the same with the life-giving water. Until finally, Inanna begins to stir and rise. Now, if you remember, the natural laws of the underworld state that once someone enters, they cannot leave. So a condition has to be put in place. Inanna may leave, but she has to provide the underworld with a replacement. So Inanna and the demons return to heaven, but they must quickly find someone to banish to the underworld. And Inanna can't seem to make a decision. The demons say, "What about your minister?" And she says, "No, I could never do that to someone who's been so loyal." They say, "Okay, what about your hairdresser, your singer, your manicurist?" But each time, Inanna says no. They even go so far as to saying, "Well, what about your son?" And Inanna says, "No, it's my son." Inanna doesn't seem willing to send anyone she loves to the underworld. And when she returns, she's found that everyone's been grieving, lamenting, weeping, and wailing. They're all in a time of mourning. So the demons and Inanna, they're continuing their way back to the temple. And it's becoming more and more apparent that they're just going to have to choose someone, anyone. But as they enter the temple, Inanna finds her husband sitting upon her throne, dressed in his finest attire, drinking and feasting and laughing, and he's surrounded by a harem of women. So in her rage, Inanna instantly commands the demons to capture her husband. Take him to the underworld. Because he did not grieve, he would become her replacement. And I actually kind of want to end here as I'm now entering into another story. But I will conclude by saying that eventually Inanna has remorse for acting out in rage. And she eventually strikes a bargain with her sister for her husband's return. And sort of like the stories of Brigid and the Horn God or the Green God or Demeter and Persephone, Inanna's husband is allowed to spend half the year with her, but does have to spend the other half of the year in the underworld. So in the descent of Inanna, we find that Inanna wasn't really a whole person until she was able to appear vulnerable before her darker half. Ultimately, she dies and then returns to life. So through her descent into darkness, the shedding of layers, the confrontation with her shadow self, with the death of who she was, and then her final rebirth, we see Inanna become a whole, complete individual. She's alchemized. She's transformed. And in the story, we have so much compassion for Inanna, for her descent, for all she's gone through. We might even feel sympathy, like she's a victim. But what if I tell you that in the beginning of the story, before her descent into the underworld, Inanna had actually found herself lusting after the hero, Gilgamesh. She tried to seduce him, but he rejected her and basically told her to go home to her husband. And in her humiliation and her rage, she decided to wage a war against him. So in order to do this, she had to have her brother-in-law, her twin sister's husband, the Bull of Heaven, captured. And she forced him to battle with Gilgamesh on her behalf. And during this battle is when her brother-in-law, her twin sister's husband, is not only killed, but has his limbs ripped from his body. And after this battle has ended and her brother-in-law is dead, this is where the descent of Inanna begins. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Narrative. If you are moved by today's episode and are looking forward to future broadcasts, be sure to hit subscribe. And as always, likes and shares are always appreciated and donations are always welcome. I had a great time with you today and I can't wait to be with you again next week. Yours truly, XOXO, Mary Rogers.